Good evening. It is Thursday, January 23rd, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. While rubbing elbows with billionaires in Davos, President Trump admits that if he is reelected, he'll seek to cut Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. Yesterday, the president openly admitted that he would, if reelected, consider cutting back funding for key social programs, including Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. This on the heels of the Trump administration announcing its plan to tighten eligibility requirements for disability benefits, especially for older Americans, and announcing the plan to slash food stamp benefits to about 668,000 people. How does this portend for the future? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. She's a communications specialist for In the Public Eye Communications, Joya Jefferson Nuri. Joya, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much, Wilmer. Thanks for having me back.
Well, thank you. So before we get to the entitlement cuts, since we're in the midst of this impeachment trial, only the third impeachment in the history of the country, I can't start the show without just asking your thoughts on what has been presented up to this point.
Well, I commend the House of Representatives for the impeachment. That was a Herculean task on their part. I'm happy about that. I do believe that in this Senate trial, many of the Republicans in the Senate should be tried later on for treason. They are not being jurors. As you are taken into a jury room, if you're taken into the courthouse and they're trying to decide who's going to be an impartial juror, I would say Mitch McConnell and several other people, had they been in voir dire, would have been dismissed because they already said, I'm going to go and do whatever the president wants me to do. You think you could sit on a jury in D.C., Wilmer, and say, oh, no circumstances, am I going to convict that person? Then neither one of the lawyers would want you on the jury. So to have members of the jury, members of the Senate, who are saying, no, no matter what you tell me, I'm going to vote to acquit, they need to be dismissed from the room as treason, because here we're protecting the Constitution. And what is happening right now is a threat to our Constitution. It is real clear in our Constitution the crime that has been made by Donald Trump, not just in this, but in other levels. But this is the one we're bringing him to trial for. So okay. I'm watching it. I think it's an exciting time to be a part of. I hope people are paying attention to this, because this is our future here. We let him get away with this, we're going to have a hard time controlling the next set of men and women in that seat.
To your point, I have a hard time understanding how Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham can put their right hands in the air and say, I swear to be impartial, when they very clearly said that they can't be.
It's a lie.
Oh, I got you. Yeah. So now, let's get to your thoughts on the president's statement from Davos that when asked by CNBC if entitlements will ever be on his plate, he said at some point they will be. We have tremendous growth. We're going to have tremendous growth. So your thoughts on the president's statements from Davos?
I think that the 45 has been living in such a bubble that he creates that he doesn't understand that Social Security and Medicare and food stamps are a third rail in politics. Nobody goes near them. I mean, food stamps might be the third on that list. WIC programs, but nobody touches Social Security or Medicare without great political threat. The people in this country who vote are the seniors. Consistently, large numbers of people who vote are the seniors. And if he expects to be reelected or have anybody in his party reelected, he will stay away from that. And even though he made that statement from Davos, the White House issues a statement that basically says, no, he ain't. So why would he say it?
You know, the problem with his very shallow analysis is that it doesn't deal with the fact that when he talks about we have tremendous growth and we're going to continue to have tremendous growth, that the financial sector of the economy is doing great. Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, they're making money like gangbusters. But the poor, the working class, and the middle class, they're struggling to keep pace, especially when you factor in healthcare and education costs, which I don't think are factored into the CPI, the Consumer Price Index.
Right.
So when you start talking about cutting Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare and food stamps, you're cutting the lifeline for a lot of people in this country.
You know, I want Donald Trump to leave Davos and go to one of his rallies in communities that he considers his base and tell them, I'm going to cut Social Security, I'm going to cut food stamps, I'm going to cut retirement programs, and I'm so great. I want those audiences, I want him to see what those audiences have to say, because they're living on Social Security, they're living on Social Security disability, they're living on food stamps, they're living on the entitlement programs that come to them as veterans, as elder people, as disadvantaged people, as poor people. Because if you look around his audiences, that's who his base is.
But he told them this in December. He told them in December that he was going to cut food stamps. He told them in January that he was going to tighten Social Security disability benefits.
What he said to them was he's going to tighten it by getting rid of fraud and waste.
Oh, absolutely. You're right.
He said all of that around fraud and waste. But since most people don't understand that those programs don't have a lot of waste, that you're actually going to get your benefits cut. Not just taking away the fraud and waste. The fraud and waste doesn't, all the audits over the last 10 years have said there's not a lot of fraud and waste in food stamps and in Social Security. There just isn't. It seems like there aren't a lot of there isn't a lot of voter fraud. People make these things up.
Right.
And then use keywords that trigger some answer, some response from you that has nothing to do with facts.
I think on the food stamp side, particularly, many people are still operating off of the Ronald Reagan welfare queen fraud that Ronald Reagan put out there, which was later proven to be nothing but false.
Right.
I think a lot of people are still operating from that mindset. But I think it is, to be fair, this is not as clear cut as Democrats versus Republicans, because Bill Clinton talked about working to end welfare as we know it. President Obama signed a farm bill that cut almost $9 billion in food stamp benefits over 10 years, causing about 850,000 households to lose $90 on average per month. Senator Sanders is challenging Joe Biden on the issue that during the 2008 campaign, Biden said he would consider changing the cost of living increases or the age eligibility for Medicare and Social Security. He said he'd do it absolutely. So we have to understand there's a political side to this in terms of rhetoric, and there's a practical side to this in terms of the impact that these cuts have on everyday American citizens.
You know, I don't want to be, there's two things. I think if politicians, the community as a whole, society as a whole, was very, very interested in cutting food stamps and welfare as we know it. And I think that those programs should be cut. I don't think there's any reason why we should have to give people money because they can't support themselves. But I think that there's no reason why we have so many people in our society who can't support themselves. Our schools suck. If you're in the criminal justice system, how to get back out into the world and become a prosperous citizen. Mm-hmm. Those programs aren't there. We have parents who aren't really parenting, with communities that don't know how to support themselves economically, not just economically, but culturally. And we're not looking at welfare is just the end result of the rest of the things we let slide
Correct.
In our society, except we call ourselves a great society. But on the other side of it, I don't want to be in a situation where I want to blame the victim. But I actually think if victims, and I'm going to tell you, audience, I have had a period in my life where things fell apart, and I went to get food stamps and cash assistance because things fell apart. Mm-hmm. My husband got very ill. And we had to get the support system there. So we had a year where that was a great support while we rebuilt.
Mm-hmm.
And I was glad it was there. But I think if the people who, like me, and like the millions of other people who have to use these services actually voted in large numbers and could organize themselves, and I'll be part of the organizing, and organize themselves, this would not be on the table.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And that's one of the ongoing questions. Why is it that many of the people who are going to be most affected by these policies aren't engaged in the process?
Right.
And there's another part of this, which to me is so patently obvious, and we've talked about it a number of times, and that is when we look at the cost of these wars, 18 years in Afghanistan, and we've spent almost $2 trillion on that war.
And killing off a generation of young men and women.
Absolutely right. And have gained nothing from it, that
right.
fueling the military-industrial complex was always the objective, and cutting social programs was always going to be the secondary objective, that it was going to be done at the expense of those programs. And now here we are,
exactly.
and Donald Trump is saying it, and everybody's going like, oh, we didn't know this. Well, no, you've been told this for a very long time.
I would tell you the most tragic of that is, and it's the one piece that will cause me to jump up and down, stomping in anger, is that we send men and women to these wars. They come back and need our help because they've been wounded psychologically,
right.
physically, emotionally, financially. And we say, we don't really have that much money for veterans.
Right.
We're going to cut those programs. And we're not going to have that available. We're going to have filthy VA hospitals. So you go and risk paying the full measure of devotion, and we have no time for you when you get back.
I got to stop you there. Joya Jefferson.
I'm sorry.
No, no.
Call me again.
No, no. Oh, we'll call you tomorrow. Joya Jefferson. Thank you so much. As always, greatly appreciate it.
All righty, Wilmer.
All right.
Nice talking to you, as always.
A pleasure.
All right.
You're listening Bye-bye. To The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. At least 9 people have died from a new coronavirus in China following an outbreak in the city of Wuhan, and more than 470 cases have been reported globally, most of them in China. What do we know about the new coronavirus spreading in China and beyond? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. She is a physician as well as co-editor of Popular Resistance, Dr. Margaret Flowers. As always, Margaret, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So it is reported that global health authorities fear the transmission rate will accelerate as hundreds of millions of Chinese travel at home and abroad during the week-long Lunar New Year holiday. China has confirmed 473 cases as of the 21st of January. This is according to the ruling Communist People's Party daily newspaper. Your thoughts on where we are with this coronavirus?
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, anytime a virus mutates and you have a new strain, it's something that's unique and, you know, people haven't faced before. You know, you worry about the spread of that virus. And I think that the Chinese government and other world governments, you know, countries around the world are being very wise to take precautions. China is saying that they are telling people not to have large public gatherings. They're clamping down on travel. They're screening people to try to, you know, make sure that they won't spread it. They're telling people what they need to do to protect themselves. And then in the United States and other countries, airports are setting up screening facilities to try to make sure that people, you know, don't come through if they're sick. Now, one of the problems is that with many of these, you know, typical cold viruses, people can transmit the virus before they actually start to have the symptoms if they're infected. So, you know, there can be a little delay where you've contracted the virus and you may be secreting it when you, you know, sneeze or whatever, but you aren't aware that you're actually sick at that point. So I think it's really smart for people to do just as they would with any cold or, you know, respiratory virus, to always take precautions, wash your hands, and don't touch dirty surfaces, and then touch your nose or mouth or eyes.
Give us, if you could please, some insight into actually what this is. Coronavirus is not in and of itself a disease or a sickness. It is a classification of virus.
Right.
So if you could, please.
Right. Yeah, sure. Sorry. Yeah, if you look at, you know, things like the common cold or respiratory infections, those are caused by hundreds of different viruses, and they vary in how severe their symptoms are. And coronavirus is a virus that does have strains that humans can contract, and typically they'll get, you know, a typical kind of cold, and most people will recover from that just fine. But this is a new strain of coronavirus. And so since, you know, many of us start to build up immunity because we're exposed to these many different viruses, when you get a new strain, that is a new thing that your body is facing. And, you know, just like any other virus, you know, most people will recover and be fine. People who are more compromised, like young children or the elderly or people who have chronic diseases, may have more of a problem if they contract this virus. But it's a new virus, and I think the concern is that they didn't really know how severe it was going to be or what the potential was for spread. And so they're still just learning about it and trying to figure out, you know, what exactly this virus is and how concerned they need to be about it. We don't know anything about those people who have died from the virus, if they were already, you know, compromised people that could have died from any kind of cold virus. So I think it's important for people not to panic too much, but at the same time, I think it's really wise to be careful. And, you know, simple things, this virus is transmitted like other cold viruses by droplets in the air. So if you sneeze or cough or, you know, however, get some saliva or mucus out of your body onto a surface, and then someone touches that surface and touches entryways like their nose or their mouth or their eyes with a dirty hand, then you can, you know, you could possibly get infected with that virus. So it just means, you know, before you eat, wash your hands. If you sneeze or cough, you know, don't touch anything. Or if you touch something, another surface, you know, just be careful about frequently washing your hands with soap and doing a good job to make sure that you're really washing all the surfaces of your hands.
One of the concerns is that it could be similar to the SARS or the severe acute respiratory syndrome virus that we found during 2002 to 2003. And if I understand, one of the reasons that the coronavirus, because it has jagged edges surrounding the virus, looking like a crown, is that right?
Right, it looks like a corona.
Corona. There we go. So to your point, we don't know yet how severe this can be. Dozens of cases have been identified in Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, Japan, Thailand, South Korea, Taiwan, and the United States. So with travel now being as fast and as prevalent as it is, and again, with this Chinese New Year, you've got a lot of people going hither and yon.
Right, and that's why I think it's wise that the Chinese government is, you know, limiting travel. They've definitely closed down the area around Wuhan, which is where the virus first began. They believe that it came from what's called a wet market, which is where live animals are sold. And so they think that it may have been a coronavirus that had infected one of the animals and then jumped from an animal to a person, which is, you know, happens sometimes. And then now they're starting to see health professionals who are treating these patients also contracting the virus. So they know now that there's human to human transmission as well. So they are taking steps. I think there were some new blockbuster movies that were supposed to come out, and they're delaying that so that people don't go to the movie theaters. They're delaying the opening of schools and just really, you know, trying to limit the spread as they learn more about the virus. They've learned that it has up to a two-week incubation period, which means that somebody could come in contact with the virus but not start to show symptoms for as late as 2 weeks. They've discovered the genetic sequence of the virus, and they've been sharing that with the World Health Organization so that other health professionals in other countries can identify whether someone has this virus. I feel like they're, you know, really doing what they can do to try to prevent the transmission of this. And I think that, you know, in the United States, I think one thing about China is they actually have a national health program.
Mm-hmm.
And so if someone gets sick, they don't have to worry about whether they can pay for the care. They can just go to the hospital and get care. That's one of the things we've always worried about in the United States, is that not everybody has access to health care. They may not have insurance, or they may not be able to afford the out-of-pocket costs. And so this is the kind of situation where it really increases our support for a national health program, because we can get a better control of these types of possible outbreaks if everyone has access to health care.
And to your point about a national health program, did I read that China is building or is dedicating two hospitals in Wuhan specifically to deal with this? They're moving quickly and decisively to deal with this problem.
Exactly. Yeah, they're converting some facilities into hospitals where people can go to get screened for this. And then if they, you know, come out positive, that they can isolate them there. And so, yes, that's part of the planning and the public health kind of approach that you can take when you have a coordinated national health system, where the interests of that system are actually to keep the population healthy. In the United States, the bottom line of our system is to make a profit. We don't have as strong of a public health infrastructure. And so that's another reason why we promote a national improved Medicare for All, because it allows you to have a system that can monitor what's going on, that, you know, can be alerted to there's this possible problem here, and then come up with a solution and direct resources at that to contain it.
But Margaret, we've got Obamacare. I thought the problem was solved. I guess not. Okay.
No.
Just a second, if you could go back to the transmission, because now we're dealing with interspecies transmission as opposed to intra, or we're dealing with both. We're dealing with interspecies as it went from this animal to a human, and then intra as we're now dealing with human to human. Is this becoming a bigger problem as time goes on?
You know, I wouldn't say that it's a bigger problem in terms of the fact that it's, you know, can be transmitted person to person, but certainly
interspecies is that becoming a bigger problem?
No, I don't think that it's still a fairly unusual type of occurrence. But in general, our risk for epidemics and pandemics, I think the fact that people can travel so easily and travel long distances has certainly made that potential for, you know, the spread of disease to have a very broad impact when things like this happen.
So in terms of countermeasures, there's no vaccine for this. And China says that it is mutating. Is that right?
I think what China said is that it was had evolved from a coronavirus, that it was a mutant.
But the
viruses can also start to evolve over time as well. But I think that would be a longer term kind of thing.
And again, so the people listening can understand, the symptoms include fever, cough, and difficulty in breathing. And so one of the things that we've been seeing in news coverage as people are going through large spaces, airports and whatnot, they're having their temperatures checked.
Right. And I think, you know, it doesn't hurt if you're traveling on a plane, especially if they're, you know, it's heading anywhere where these viruses have been found. It's not a bad idea to wear, you know, a mask on your face. Lots of people do that to protect themselves from infectious diseases. So if you're worried about it, that's something you can do. But I think hand washing is just, I can't stress enough. It's a simple thing to do. But if you're touching a dirty surface and then you touch your mouth or nose or eyes, you have the possibility of infecting yourself. So it's really important to be aware of what you're touching and keep your hands clean.
And there has been one case documented here in Washington State.
Correct.
And that individual has been hospitalized. and they are providing the treatment that is needed. So to your point earlier, we don't need to panic, but we do need to pay attention. You know, you mentioned their national health system, and I find it interesting, you know, because we talk about China being this incredibly
authoritarian,
thank you. And so what they've done, they've banned all large gatherings over the coming Lunar New Year festival, most importantly, the holiday, which is the important holiday on the Chinese calendar. I just imagine if this happened at Christmas here in the United States, the outcry there would be if the government banned all large gatherings for Christmas or so, you know, something like that. Where in China, they say, hey, this is how it's going to go. And folks say, okay, this is how it's going to go. Because they are looking at the interest of the whole as opposed to the profits of the individual.
Yeah, I think that calling China authoritarian is kind of a typical kind of U.S. propaganda towards China.
Right.
And I think it's important for us to recognize that this is it's a different kind of democracy in China. They mm-hmm. have a different system and they do a lot of state planning, which is why they've been able to make some of the achievements that they've been able to make in reducing wealth inequality, reducing poverty, you know, creating public infrastructure like transportation systems and, you know, all of these things that where they are superior to the United States in a lot of ways. And that's because they do called state-centric capitalism, where they control how the projects go instead of just being like this kind of system, this money system we have here, where it's kind of like a buddy. You try to give money to your buddies because you like them. You know, it's not really planned out as well. So it's a different system. And I think that being able to take these strong measures when you're concerned about something that could have such great impacts.
Yes.
You know, that it's important that countries are able to take those steps to protect their population.
Because they're talking about quarantining around 25 million people. And from what I've read.
Until they figure out what's going on.
They get the problem solved. Dr. Margaret Flowers, as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your insight and your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is still more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Russian President Vladimir Putin proposes a 2020 summit with the leaders of Russia, France, China, U.S., and the U.K. Today, he proposed holding a summit between these leaders in 2020 to discuss the conflict in Libya and other global problems. He was speaking during a trip to Israel and said that Moscow was ready for a serious conversation with the permanent members of the UN Security Council, that there was much to discuss, and that the summit could happen anywhere in the world. What are we to make of this? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He's an international affairs and security analyst, Mark Sloboda. Mark, as always, welcome back.
Dr. Leon, thanks for having me.
So this is not getting much play here in the U.S., is this a significant gesture?
It is a good gesture.
Okay.
There is absolutely nothing wrong with the idea that the leaders of the five UN Security Council countries should probably get together once a year amongst themselves, you know, not just their diplomats arguing with each other and talking past each other and making political theater at the UN Security Council, but actually having a face-to-face get-together, the recognized peers that set, you know, what should be global security anyway within the bounds of international law at the United Nations, you know, the P5 members of the Security Council. It's a good idea. But if there's an idea that this is supposed to be something in particular about the conflict in Libya or whatever other global problems Putin has in mind for them discussing, and that they are going to sit down and solve the conflict in Libya or even agree on it. That, I think, is somewhat unlikely. And Putin, with doing this, is on one hand, making a broad diplomatic political gesture, but I think it's also a bit Putin warming to a role that he has been missing for a few years. For a few years, Putin has basically been on the outs, not from the international community in the true sense of the word, but from the West. And he has basically been shunned and ostracized by Western leaders in disagreements over the events, you know, starting with the 2014 U.S. backed putsch in Ukraine that overthrew the government there, and the situation that developed further with the West going in on one side and Russia supporting the other. And he has recently basically been reaccepted into that august international club. He's had Angela Merkel has come to Moscow for the first time in years. Macron has made diplomatic overtures towards restoring relations with Russia, and he just is meeting with the world leaders in Israel for this year's Holocaust memorial anniversary. And Putin would like to keep that string continuing and remind the world that Russia is one of the top countries in the world that does or should be deciding matters of global international security at the UN Security Council with the other members of the P5.
To that point, and I think that that's a great point, because one of the narratives that we've been hearing here for a number of years is that with the breakup of the Soviet Union, that President Putin has been trying very desperately to find his relevance on the world stage, that he has, in a weakening Russia, that Putin has been trying to find the relevance of Russia. And what I have seen here is, over the last few years, he's been traversing the world to a great degree being a voice of reason. Whether we look at Syria, whether we look at Libya, you know, we can look at a lot of places of unrest. We can look at the forays or the entrees that he made as it related to Venezuela. I've found him to be on the right side of a lot of issues. So am I right here, or am I being naive and fooled by the Russian propaganda that keeps permeating my computer?
Yeah, well, I certainly agree that Russia's, and in particular Putin's, with Lavrov as his quite competent foreign minister wingman, has charted a foreign policy course of realism and pragmatism that is something that is sorely lacking, unfortunately, in most Western countries' foreign policy and worldview.
Oh, wait a minute, Mark. I'm sorry. Let me jump in. And there was one other point that I wanted to add to that. And to me, it's a very important point, that President Putin has been doing this through diplomacy and not so much at the barrel of a gun.
Well, he certainly has intervened in Syria with, mm-hmm. I think, a very deciding military intervention to save the government there from
right.
a West and Gulf-backed regime change. But at the same time, he has presented the Russian government as the one factor that all parties in the conflict can talk to,
right?
Can deal with, as kind of the honest broker, even as Russia is a party to the conflict. And that is also how he has tried to position Russia in the Libya conflict,
mm-hmm.
starting as a very exaggerated view of Russia as a party to the conflict because of a Russian security contractors there. But now he is trying to maneuver Russia into the role of mediator to set the terms. And that is a role that Russia, which presents itself, and I think it often is more than other countries, as preferring to work within the bounds of international law and enforcing that system's code on other countries' behavior, that's certainly something that Putin pushes for in international relations.
What about the fact that he's proposing a meeting of Security Council members getting together outside of the confines or purview of the UN itself, that he's saying we can have this meeting anywhere in the world? Does the fact that he's not calling for this to take place at the UN, is that something of note?
Yeah, I think it is, because it is posing a somewhat more informal meeting where these countries can come to some kind of post-World War II like settlement about how to govern global international security amongst themselves. And it's really quite amazing that this hasn't been done before. I mean, we've had the meeting of the G7 and the G8. We've had the meetings of the G20 on economics, but we don't have an international yearly or any type of regular summit among the members, the P5 members of the Security Council, the ones that are supposed to set the rules of international security and enforce. And a part of that is because they've disagreed so much through the decades on that, be that during the Cold War or now well past the post-Cold War era, you know, down into what some people refer to as the dawning of a multipolar world. And it's definitely something that should have happened before. But if we take a look at the microcosm of the case of Libya, right, and the crisis there is continuing on from 2011, when the U.S., the EU, and Gulf countries initiated a regime change operation using jihadi proxies and bombing to destroy the government there and to kill Muammar Gaddafi. And obviously, after that happened, the U.S. and the EU, they didn't seem never have heard of the concept of you broke it, you bought it. And the country has devolved into warring warlords, a haven for international terrorism. Al-Qaeda and ISIS have gotten footholds there. It's become a major refugee source center, putting refugees into Europe from the rest of Africa, just like Gaddafi warned. And, there have been fluctuations in the oil supply, which, of course, is what the EU was really concerned about there. The U.S., under the Trump administration, has made perfectly clear they're not really interested in Libya and been almost completely hands-off the situation. They don't really care right now. The UK, likewise, hasn't taken much of a position on it, hasn't gotten itself involved. They seem to be too embroiled in Brexit and their own domestic problems to focus on an extra international situation like that. China doesn't have a lot of direct interest. Libya is on the far side of the world from them, and would probably mostly follow Russia's lead as a partner, generally on sovereignty and international security matters or some on the Security Council. That leaves Russia and France, and those are the only two countries that are seeming active. France from the beginning with the regime change efforts, and Russia now stepping into a power vacuum to restore some of the assets, the energy and railroad contracts that they had with the Gaddafi government before it was overthrown. But Russia and France at this point are backing the same guy. They're both backing Haftar. So there's not even a lot of disagreement there. But if it's a good excuse for the countries to get together, whether or not they can or are even interested in solving the Libya conflict together at this point, it's still a good idea to have the meeting, and it should have been done before those regards.
And I guess the big question will be, will the outcome of this, or will the actual intent of a meeting such as this be a Berlin conference going back to the 1884 conference that regulated European colonization of the continent and basically carved up Africa for the imperialism period that we're still suffering from today? Or does it become more of a Bandung conference, which was to promote Afro-Asian economic and cultural cooperation in response to European colonization? So is that a fair question to ask?
Yeah, I mean, those are possibilities that would certainly fall into consideration, in two different extreme possibilities. I think the reality is it would probably end up more like an informal networking session and photo opportunity, much like the G8 and the G20 meeting, where nothing of very import, either good or bad, was actually decided there. But at the same time, getting these five world leaders, you know, again, the P5 members of the Security Council, supposedly the members with you know, the most military muscle in the world, you know, a little outdated at this point, with India and a few others not at the table, you know, but that was the post World War II makeup of the world. It's still a good idea to get them together and discuss some things face to face rather than having their diplomats yell at each other across the Security Council table.
Mark Sloboda, as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you.
All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Extradition hearing for WikiLeaks' Julian Assange will now be split into two parts. The London hearing to decide whether Julian Assange can be extradited to the United States or will be extradited to the United States to face charges, including spying, will be split into two, the second half delayed until May. This according to a ruling today. What does this mean? How does all this portend for Mr. Assange? For insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. As always, Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, Mr. Assange, he's 48 years old. He faces 18 counts in the United States, including conspiring to hack government computers and violating an espionage law. If convicted, he could spend decades in prison. Does the fact now that this hearing is being split into two parts, with the second half being delayed until May, does that mean anything to you?
Well, the main lesson I draw from it is that his counsel is having a very hard time gaining access. They aren't making Assange very very available to his lawyers, and consequently, the case is dragging on. So it seems that the defense is having major impediments being put in its path.
But if the impediments being put in the defense counsel's path were a scheme to make it easier for him to be extradited, wouldn't the judge's answer to the defense counsel's request be, it's not our problem, show up tomorrow, let's get this done, because he's got a flight leaving at 7 p.m. to get him back to the United States?
Yes, on one level, yes. But no, this is Britain, and they have a very highly evolved justice system. So it sort of works slowly, and it's got to be sort of handled delicately. I'm afraid that, you know, that things look very bad. I think with the Johnson government, very right-wing government, very pro-American, I think that his chances of fighting this thing successfully are looking slimmer and slimmer.
His extradition hearing, the first part, is scheduled to start the 24th of February. That's supposed to last for a week, with the remaining 3 weeks taking place starting May 18th. Both sides are arguing that they need more time to prepare and gather evidence. I find that interesting. I understand the defense needing access to their client, but in terms of arguing that they need time to gather evidence, I don't know. What else can be uncovered here?
Well, there's a great deal that can be uncovered. There's evidence of collusion between U.S., British, and Swedish legal authorities, for example, any evidence that that the case in Sweden, which, as your listeners may be aware, was a very curious, very strange sex case that never really quite held together. But there are all kinds of rumors of political tricks behind the scenes. So if I was Julian Assange's lawyer, I'd want to know something about that. Any evidence that the case was deliberately brought in order to essentially use it as a weapon to stop Assange.
And to your point, the first part of the full hearing, which starts again in February, is going to cover arguments that the extradition is politically motivated and an abuse of process. Talk about that factually versus politically, if that question makes sense.
Well, it does make sense. I mean, extradition is a standard legal instrument. If you commit a murder in the United States and flee to Great Britain, for example, there's a certain procedure by which U.S. authorities can have you extradited to the U.S. to stand trial, and it's quite standard. We all understand why it's the rational thing to do in certain circumstances. But in the Assange case, you're dealing with, number one, with a U.S. administration which has shown its bad faith on multiple occasions, and which has also shown its essential lawlessness through things like the assassination of Qasem Soleimani 2 weeks ago, I believe it was, in mm-hmm. Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
And the recent threat, by the way, of the U.S. Emissary to Iran to assassinate Soleimani's successor, if the U.S. so pleases. So the question is whether this is a regime that can be trusted to administer justice in any reasonable sense of the term. And certainly, Assange has infuriated the U.S. political establishment in the most profound sense of the word. So he has everything to fear that this lawless regime in Washington will behave vindictively, illegally, and unjustly. So these are all questions that would be raised during the extradition case. Unfortunately, he's dealing with a government in Great Britain, which is not much better and seems to sympathize with be highly sympathetic to Trump's point of view, so he's fighting an uphill war.
Do you have any insight into the relationship between Boris Johnson's government and the court system? So, for as sympathetic as Boris Johnson is to Donald Trump, and many have called him Trump Jr., does Boris Johnson hold sway over the magistrates in London, or do they operate in a freer capacity, or do they operate in a more collegial or congenial capacity than judges here?
The answer is an unequivocal yes and no. The British judicial system was one of the oldest in the world,
mm-hmm.
and judges pride themselves on their independence, and that's not entirely a myth. On the other hand, they live in they're part of a British political system, and the political system has just taken a giant step to the right with the election last month of Boris Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Now that giant step makes itself felt in any number of ways, subtle and unsubtle. So certainly the judge in the case is aware of which way the wind is blowing and knows, is under great pressure to do the government's bidding. And so conceivably the judge could withstand that pressure. But we all know that realistically that becomes a somewhat difficult thing to do.
Do they have Kavanaughs running around on the high courts in London?
Not exactly, but British justice, is famous for the Tories and horsehair wigs,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
who have a very reactionary view of the world, even while prodding themselves on their independence. So I think the judiciary in general tends to be establishmentarian in the political sense of the word.
So I guess the real politique element of my question, Boris Johnson with the whole Brexit situation is hoping to carve out a very good trade deal with the Trump administration and the United States. Does Julian Assange's fate become a pawn in that debate?
Yes, it does. Not directly, not in a mechanical way, but surely if this judge defied the U.S. and, you know, and said no to extradition because the U.S. was simply legally not a trustworthy party because it's lawless, it's unjust, that the highest political circles have made known their animosity towards Assange, and the U.S. has a long record of extrajudicial punishment, as in Guantanamo Bay, for example. If the judge therefore says that the U.S. is not a trustworthy party, and I cannot, in good conscience, remand, extradite Assange to such a country, well, then yes, we know there would be hell to pay. Okay, and we know that hell would make itself felt in any number of ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, Britain would really feel Trump's wrath, and that wrath would then be, would then manifest itself, economically, militarily, et cetera, et cetera. So, is it possible that Britain will say no to extradition? Yeah, it's possible. Is it likely? No, it's not likely.
And part of that hell could be Meghan Markle and Prince Harry could move to the U.S. and we'd really be nauseated by that foolishness. Claire Dobbin, the lawyer representing the U.S. interests, says that they're opposed to allowing Assange calling anonymous witnesses. That, to me, the use of that term I find to be very interesting, and that they're also going to have to hear evidence about his mental state. Your thoughts?
Yes, they will have to hear evidence of mental state, but that sort of cuts both ways. I mean, Assange is a man. He seems to be in very poor health. He has really suffered after 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy, confined to a very small space, and now is in a maximum security prison where apparently
in solitary confinement, I believe.
Solitary, little opportunity for exercise. I have no idea what the food is like. And there's always the possibility, we don't know, of some kind of drugs being administered.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's not unreasonable to speculate about that. So he is he seems to be, from the brief glimpses we've caught of him, he seems to have been, not responsive, kind of foggy. And this, by the way, is a guy who was normally, he was extremely sharp.
Right.
Quick on his feet, extremely sharp, really a top-notch mind, et cetera. So he seems foggy. He seems out of it. He seems unresponsive. And so, yes. So this is all legally of the, highly pertinent because it speaks to his conditions of imprisonment in Great Britain. And it also speaks to how he'll be treated in the U.S., whether he'll be given the treatment he needs, whether he'll be treated in a humanitarian way, or whether, he can reasonably expect to be thrown into some dungeon or cave for the rest of his life.
And I can't express enough to my audience, and we'll get out with you responding to this, how important this is to independent journalism, not only in this country, but around the world. If the United States is able to prosecute/persecute Julian Assange, that's going to speak volumes to independent journalists and what it means to tell the truth, no matter who gets embarrassed behind what is said.
Absolutely, because the techniques that Assange used are used by other newspapers, Washington Post, New York Times, et cetera, et cetera. And if he's stopped, they will be stopped. And very interestingly, the Bolsonaro government in Brazil, a far right wing, semi fascist government, has launched a nearly identical case against Glenn Greenwald, a very well known journalist and a very hard hitting journalist, accusing him of this. It's almost as if they downloaded the indictment against Assange. And used Whiteout to cross out certain sections and write in Greenwald's name. So, you know, they're accusing him of the same thing of, you know, of hacking, collaborating with hacking, with hackers, engaging in a conspiracy to hack, et cetera, all of which is meant to silence a journalist who has infuriated, you know, the highest, you know, political circles. So, you know, so if Assange goes, Greenwald goes, the American press grows even more timid and conformist than it already is. You know, we're moving into a dark authoritarian time.
And the irony to the timidity point that you just made is the New York Times, early on in this process, used Assange's information. MSNBC, in the early stages of this process, used Assange's information. And did it and touted it and flaunted it and was proud to do so. And now all of a sudden, their silence is deafening.
Because he's been identified as a Russian agent by Robert Mueller, and suddenly he's now the enemy. So therefore, you know, according to Robert Mueller, the Russiagate investigator, special prosecutor, he collaborated with Russian intelligence, which fed him the Hillary Clinton DNC emails that he then put you know online, which I think is clearly untrue according to all the available evidence. But nonetheless, that has made him persona non grata in the eyes of the Times, the Washington Post, etc. So essentially, he has been cut off, isolated, deprived of support, turned into an outcast, and therefore someone who government in both England, Britain, and the U.S. feels free to punish, you know, to torture with impunity.
And to your point, according to Bill Binney, former NSA, and Ray McGovern, former CIA, and others, the whole hacking theory defies the laws of physics. So with that, Daniel Lazar, as always, sir, thank you so much. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
All right. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.